Yes, thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here. So within the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, I co-chair the detector characterization group. So we sit just in between the detector instrumentation and the astrophysics and data analysis. So if you have any question about any aspect of either of those sides of the experiment, please feel free to ask anytime. So I'm sure, as you've no doubt heard, that gravitational waves are a unique probe of physics. So they are extremely weakly interacting, which makes them very difficult to detect, as we'll see. But that also means that they're this crystal clear messenger of the inner dynamics of astrophysical phenomena. So because they're so weakly interacting, we expect them to propagate effectively completely undisturbed by clouds of dust, by light. They'll pass straight through the Earth. So we expect to receive on Earth this unaltered signature of what the inner dynamics of some of these dark and astrophysically interesting systems are. So I want to frame this seminar in the context of some very important discoveries. So this plot will probably look familiar to a fair few of you. So this is the detector and the data, rather, in the two advanced LIGO detectors. This is the first detection of gravitational waves in back in 2015. So what you're seeing here is a signature in LIGO Hanford and LIGO Livingston, the two LIGO detectors that are in the United States. And indeed, as we expect, we see this time frequency evolution for these binary black holes sweeping upwards in frequency and also increasing in amplitude, exactly as we expect from general relativity. So this is the first ever direct detection of gravitational waves, the first detection of black holes in a binary, and also the first observation of stellar mass black holes above roughly 20 solar masses. And then, arguably even more exciting, in 2017, was the detection of gravitational waves from the merger of two neutron stars. So here again, we see spectrograms. So here we have the two LIGO detectors, and now also our sister detector, Virgo. Virgo in Italy is also online at the time. So you can see the clearest signal in LIGO Livingston. So this is the most sensitive of the three detectors in the network at the time. But take note of what you see in the Virgo detector at this time. So this will be very important later on when we think about sky localization. But the reason this is so exciting is because this neutron star detection was also the first example of multi-messenger astronomy with gravitational waves. So using this gravitational wave signature from the three detectors, the two advanced LIGO detectors and the Virgo detector, a sky map, a three-dimensional sky map, was generated and used to identify this kilonova in the host galaxy NGC 4993. So here you can see it growing more red and dimming over time. And in studying this kilonova and the accompanying electromagnetic radiation all across the spectrum, so gamma rays all the way to radio waves, just with this one event alone, we've learned new physics about jets, about how heavy elements are propagating and generated within the universe. So within this context, what I'm going to do is walk through from gravitational wave generation. So we're going to talk about sources of gravitational waves. We'll walk through gravitational wave detection with interferometers, and then how we take that data from interferometers and use it to infer these astrophysical properties. And then this context will set us up to discuss the major outstanding challenges in the field. So gravitational waves, so they propagate as space-time strain, so that's little h here. So this is the space-time strain amplitude. So it's proportional to the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment. This is some asymmetric acceleration of mass. You'll also notice that it's proportional to a very small number over a very, very large number. And something I want to take care to point out is that unlike in, let's say, optical astronomy, where you're trying to capture the flux of photons and your signal strength is going to go as 1 over r squared. Here, when we're directly sensing the amplitude of space-time strain, our signal strength goes as 1 over r. So keep that in mind as well. So let's say we have some asymmetric acceleration of mass, some variation in our quadrupole moment. So this will generate space-time strain associated with this gravitational wave signal. So we describe it, this little h, as the change in length over length. So you see the effect here. These are 2 rings of test masses that are indicating strain on the order of 1. So this is for a gravitational wave that's propagating into or out of the screen. And there are 2 orthogonal polarizations here, cross and plus. But it's this relative stretching and squeezing in these orthogonal directions that's going to motivate the shape of our detectors. So knowing this expected behavior, we choose to build our interferometers in the shape of 2 orthogonal arms. So this is a basic schematic of a laser interferometer like LIGO and Virgo. So we have some input laser light. It encounters a beam splitter here. So 50% of the light is going to travel in the y direction and 50% in the x. So where for advanced LIGO, these arms are 4 kilometers long. And then the light travels back to the beam splitter, and part of it is sensed here at the output port. So for any relative change in length between these 2 arms, this will introduce a relative phase in the light that's circulating, and we'll be able to read the signal out directly as gravitational wave strain amplitude at our output port. So we have a network of these detectors. So 2 of them, the advanced LIGO detectors, are in the United States. So LIGO Hanford here up in the desert in eastern Washington, LIGO Livingston in the swamp in Louisiana. There's also Virgo. So this is a 3-kilometer long detector in Italy. And then happy news to report here that some of these colors should be changed as of very recently. So Kagera has now come online and is operational, undergoing commissioning, preparing to join this current observing run. And LIGO India has also broken ground and is now under construction. And then I would be remiss to not also mention this 600-meter interferometer called GEO-600 that's been the prototype for a lot of the really critical technologies that we employ in LIGO and Virgo. Okay, so we have this global network of interferometers. So for the past few observing runs, this has been LIGO and Virgo. And they generate data that looks something like this. So here's the amplitude of my time series. This is space-time strain versus time. And my goal, if I have some quiet signal buried in my data, is to identify it. And because I know that gravitational waves are weakly interacting, and I expect to see them largely unaffected, even after they've traveled vast distances, I can employ this really powerful technique of matched filtering. So the premise of matched filtering is that I can populate some bank of templates, some set of models that span what I expect my detector to be sensitive to. So for advanced LIGO, this ranges from roughly 1 solar mass, so a binary neutron star, all the way up to starting to probe intermediate mass black hole ranges. So this is a plot from the first observing run template bank, which has about 250,000 templates in it. This has since been extended to probe both lower total mass and also higher total mass. And I can further save myself some computational expense because I'm going to perform this mesh filter search with each and every one of these dots. So each dot represents a template. I can also think about how spin is affecting the time frequency evolution of my model. So for models that include a neutron star, so that's the green and red here, I can impose this astrophysically motivated spin constraint. So I can look to electromagnetic observations and see that any neutron star that's in a pair that's going to spin down within a Hubble time has a spin of less than 0.05 that's aligned with its orbital angular momentum. So I can also choose to apply this constraint and populate this template bank of models. And once I do this, I compare each and every one of these to my data, which looks something like this. So for every model in my template bank, I'm going to slide it across my noisy data and compute this cross-correlation, which is directly related to the signal-to-noise ratio. And even though my model might not exactly match the true signal that's buried in the data, I'm still going to get this cross-correlation, this very strong hit that we call a trigger. So I repeat this for all 250,000 to a million of my templates in my template bank, and then this is reported to me through a pipeline we call a search as a trigger. So my next goal is to try to determine how significant is that trigger? How likely would it have been due to noise in my global array of interferometers? So what you're looking at here is this network reweighted signal to noise ratio. So this is directly related to the cross correlation we just computed and then the quadrature sum for every detector in my network. So that's what this number is. And this dashed blue line here that you see, this is the real measured network signal-to-noise ratio for this gravitational wave event. This is the second ever detection of a binary black hole system, 15-12-26. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to empirically measure my noise background. And then I'm going to compare this value, this signal-to-noise ratio for my trigger, to how likely I would expect to see it based on that noise background. So for example, we have two different distributions that are both generated using LIGO data, and we'll see what they are exactly in a little while. But if I compare this value of my trigger, the signal-to-noise ratio, to this background distribution in gray, then I find that it's over 5 sigma in significance, very likely to be a true astrophysical signal. However, if I compare it to this background distribution in red, then it is less than 3 sigma and would have at the time only garnered it a trigger and not a gold-plated GW event. So how do I measure this noise background? So because the noise in my detectors is non-Gaussian and non-stationary and very, very difficult to model, what I do is I essentially do this empirically. So we use a technique called time slides. So here are 3 different data streams. This is the output of my matched filter search for 3 different detectors in my network. I could also do this for any number of detectors greater than 1. And what I do is I shift the data of one detector by a time delta t that's greater than the light travel time or the gravitational wave travel time between my detectors, which is roughly 10 milliseconds. And then I can do this for the next detector in my network by a factor of 2 times delta t, and so on. And I can shift this data such that any true astrophysical signal in the data will not give me this coincidence match. However, now I'm going to start to see chance coincidences from noise. So now I can compute this network SNR statistic that is must necessarily be due to noise. And if I time slide my data by as many values, integers of delta t as I can fit within my observing run, then this can give me a very significant histogram reaching to very low rates. So this is essentially the principle of how we measure significance relative to the noise. So let's say we've done this. Let's say we've compared our trigger value to this gray histogram here. We've decided that this is a significant candidate. So our next goal is to try to determine what it is.
Sorry, what was the red line curve then?
The black line?
You have a gray curve and a red curve.
Yes.
Red point.
I missed the last part of your question.
You have gray points, mm-hmm. And then you have red points. You have 2 different backgrounds.
That's true.
So this one, yeah, what's the difference?
Yes, that is a great question, which we will answer. I'll give you a preview. So spoiler alert. What we'll see later is that the red curve is if I assume that everything taken within observing mode is representative of my background at all times. The gray curve is what you get if you're careful about your data quality and you're thinking about the way that your interferometer is interacting with your environment and you're carefully cutting out parts of the data.
Regarding noise, do you have a noise distribution? Do you assume it's Gaussian?
Do we assume our noise is Gaussian? There are elements of our analyses that do assume that the noise is Gaussian. So the match filter searches are, they try to take this into account with what we call chi-squared. So the value that you see here, this signal-to-noise ratio is actually downweighted by this chi-squared test. We're testing whether the excess power that's present in your data is consistent with what you expect the signal to look like for the template that was triggered. So for the Bayesian approach, yes, we do. But we also have a sophisticated algorithm that looks at what power is coherent between detectors and what part of the power is not coherent or consistent with a noise transient and just fit the power that is coherent. It's the likelihood where this comes into account for, that's right. So you assume that your likelihood, so you set your likelihood to expect your noise to be consistent with a Gaussian distribution. That's right. That's our Bayesian approach.
You have to worry about the amount of time that you're actually looking at the signal.
That's very true.
So the standard analysis, you assume an infinite time, so to speak, lots of theorems, which you don't have. You only have fractions of seconds.
Yep, that's true. We tend to also approach this a bit empirically. So we have, we'll see what the noise curve looks like, but we have very limited sensitivity below about 30 hertz. So we treat this as a hard cutoff. And yes, especially for binary black hole systems, this really limits the time duration of the model within the data. Good questions. Other questions?
Yeah, you might be talking about this later, but in terms of the difference between the gray and red, is part of it that in one of them you take out the portions with the suspected signal?
Not in this particular curve, but that's exactly what was done in the discovery paper. You remember quite rightly.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? All right. So now that we have decided that our trigger is significant and likely to be astrophysical, our next challenge is to determine what it is. So here what you're looking at, so this is the strain amplitude on the y-axis versus time. And then I have some data here in blue, and this is whitened with some whitening filter. And then overlaid on top of it is this model in orange. And we're going to see what happens at a very basic level when I change the total mass of my system and try to align this model in phase with my data. And then again, remembering that our signal amplitude goes directly as 1 over r, once I have a good phase alignment, I can scale my data to get a rough measurement of the distance. And this distance measurement is completely independent of any kind of a distance ladder. This is an independent standard siren. So let's see what this looks like. So first, I evolve my model in phase by changing the total mass until I get a good alignment. And then I'm going to scale it to get an estimate of my distance. And now I apply the same whitening filter to it as I did to my data in blue. And for a model, so for a numerical relativity simulation aligned with this data, so this is from the first detection, 1509-14, it was over 99% agreement between the NR prediction and the data.
When you do this, you fix the spins to zero during this first stage, right?
Yes, this is a very, very simple cartoonish example and an excellent segue, thank you. So in reality, this is much harder in practice to do. So we use this fully Bayesian approach. We do allow the spins to vary. So it depends on the model family that you're looking at. So this is assuming this phenom P, which includes precession effects. All of these curves are generated with that waveform family. But yes, so once you've identified significant triggers, you can do a Bayesian treatment to see, yes?
Just to make sure that I understood then, in the search, so it was what you were searching. Showing before, right? Mm-hmm. So you fix the spins to zero, and then you allow them to vary in the variance estimation.
If I understand your question correctly, we use match filtering to identify interesting times in the data, and then once, yes, and then we apply this Bayesian treatment once we've identified those times.
But when you do the match filtering, mm-hmm. you allow the spins to vary or not?
Yes, we do allow, so it's the, what we're sensitive to for gravitational wave emission is the spin that's aligned, the component of the spin that's aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the system. So yes, we do allow that to vary.
Okay. Thank you.
Good question. Other questions? Okay, so what you're looking at here, so these are the estimates for the two component masses of each one of the 11 gold-plated significant events in the catalog from the first and second observing runs for LIGO and Virgo. So we define M1 here to be the heavier of the two masses. And then you're seeing a curve for each one of the 11 sources. And you might notice that the lower mass systems tend to follow this particular banana-like shape. So this will be familiar to many of you here, but this is tracing at what we call the chirp mass. So this is what's going to govern the time frequency evolution to dominate that signal, particularly at lower total mass systems. So that's a function of the product of the two masses and the total mass. And then at higher mass systems, we tend to be more dominated by the total mass of the system. But you can also see in these dashed lines here the different mass ratios. So all the signals so far are consistent with equal masses, and then only a few of them with a higher, potentially with a higher mass ratio. So what else can we learn from gravitational wave information alone? So here you're looking at a beam pattern. So this is a beam pattern for any given detector. This happens to be Virgo's beam pattern projected onto the sky at the time of the binary neutron star detection. So the colors are telling you where, relative to the detector in the sky, you are more or less sensitive. So these two dark red regions you see here, these are directly overhead of the detector, so propagating like this relative to your arms. And you'll also see four null points where we have no or very limited sensitivity. And this is for a gravitational wave that's propagating at a 45 degree angle from your arms, so you get no relative displacements. So overlaid over this colored schematic in teal, this sort of a spliced banana shape here. So this is the sky map that you get if you just use the two advanced LIGO detectors. And here is why I wanted you to remember that it was so difficult to see the signal in advance in Virgo. So we actually got pretty lucky that the signal happened to be very close to a Virgo null point. This is what allowed us to isolate the sky map so well. So it's this sky map that you're looking at right here between LIGO and Virgo that was used to identify the host galaxy of the kilonova. Sure, go ahead.
So if it wasn't close to a null point, but you would have seen the signal on all three detectors, it would have been more difficult to pinpoint as well.
That's right. Because these null regions are so well localized to the sky relative to this really broad red region, it definitely did give us more information about where in the sky it could or could not have been. All right, so here's a sense of how well we can do a sky localization with gravitational wave detectors versus electromagnetic emission, particularly gamma ray satellites. So what you're looking at here is the sky map just from the Fermi gamma ray satellite, and then this ring that you see here is the timing that you get when you compare the Fermi and Integral satellites. And then overlaid in green is again this kind of spliced banana feature that's the two advanced LIGO detectors. And here's what happens when we add a third detector, advanced Virgo. And remember that we also get a distance measurement. So this is a three-dimensional sky map that we see here that allowed astronomers to isolate the galaxies that were within that three-dimensional sky map and identify correctly the eventually, about 9 hours later, the host galaxy, and this is NGC 4993. So what else can we do with gravitational wave information alone? So we can start to learn about very dense matter. So what you're looking at here, this is a posterior probability function for the value of the tidal deformability of the neutron stars that merged for the event 170817. So this tidal deformability lambda is related to the radius of the neutron star over its mass to the fifth power. This is what we see incorporated in the gravitational wave signal. So this is the likelihood that lambda has some particular value versus the value. And then coming back to your very good question about waveform families, we show posteriors from multiple different waveform families, with this Taylor F2 being purely post-Newtonian and not including any tidal effects whatsoever, being the worst constraint that we have here. So these are all 90% likelihood lines for each one of these waveform families. And the most advanced is this phenom P, including precession effects. And whenever you see a NRT, that means numerical relativity tidal. So particularly if we compare the data that we get, the posterior that we get with this precession waveform family, and we compare this to models for the neutron star equation of state that are overlaid here in gray, just from one event, we're already learning about dense nuclear systems. So we can exclude, even with our, let's say, least sophisticated model for these waveforms, we can already exclude some of these less dense models of the neutron star equation of state. And as we build up more events and get more information from gravitational waves, we expect we should be able to do even better at probing what the equation of state for these highly dense systems is.
Swing to
run to mid-sentence. Oh, no, I was coasting right to the end of that sentence. Please go ahead.
Okay. Why does the prior go to zero at zero?
So this is essentially telling you that these objects have matter. So because the density is non-zero, then we are assuming that they have some volume to them. So this is interesting in the sense that we have we can not quite exclude, but we're fairly sure that they're not black holes.
Which compound objects are we talking about?
So these are two neutron stars.
Which ones are not black holes?
Well, as Cecilia very brightly pointed out, we can be fairly sure just from gravitational waves that they're not, but then we also have the evidence of the kilonova and how much mass would have been ejected.
Well, I think Cecilia was asking about the prior, which also goes to zero because you're assuming they're not black holes.
Ah, okay, I think I misheard your question. You were asking why the prior goes to zero. Yes, that's right. So in the first discovery paper, we did not assume that the prior went to zero, and we didn't get as strong of a posterior that these had matter in them. And then here we do. We do assume that they're not black holes. We also constrain the two neutron stars to have the same equation of state here.
Maybe you can't do this for black holes. The first solution doesn't have any matter.
Right. Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. You had a question, Cole?
Yeah. I mean, in fact, from the gravitational waves alone, isn't it the case that you cannot exclude that this is a black hole and a neutron star, or even two black holes?
That's right. If you don't set your prior to zero, yes, that's exactly right. Or something else more exotic.
So what are these vertical lines you have? Didn't get that.
So each one of the vertical lines corresponds to one of these posterior shapes, which is associated with a different waveform family that incorporates different physics and its assumptions. So the one that's shaded in, this darker blue here, is phenom P. So it includes precession effects and gives us, we think, the most realistic of them.
I don't think I'm following. So you have curves and you have vertical lines.
Oh, right. So the vertical lines, these are the 90% likelihood bounds for the posterior. Okay. Excellent questions. Other questions? All right. So what can we do if we incorporate electromagnetic information? So using this independent distance estimate from gravitational waves, if you combine this with the redshift from the kilonova, as identified optically, you can make this posterior, this likelihood distribution for the Hubble constant, having some value. And it's this curve we see here, which was also generated with the phenom P waveform family. And superimposed on this plot also are other measurements made at very different redshifts. And there's a recent claim from about the late spring that this is a 5 sigma discrepancy now between these values of the Hubble constant. But what you're looking at here, so in the salmon-y pink color, this is the estimated value if you do a type 1a supernova survey. So this is at nearer redshift. And then this green here is from the cosmic microwave backgrounds and via Planck at a much, much higher redshift. So you might notice that this posterior does not do very much to distinguish between these two competing values. But we hope, we expect, I should say, that if we get on the order of tens of binary neutron star detections jointly with electromagnetic counterparts, we should be able to start resolving this value much more precisely. Or alternatively, on the order of hundreds of events where you're doing a statistical survey of the redshifts of galaxies contained within the sky map. So where are we now? So these are all of the significant gold-plated events that were released with the catalog from about a year ago. So these are all the events from the first and second observing runs. So there are some labeled V here that included Virgo data, but essentially you're looking at the date and time of arrival. And then something I want to draw your attention to is that these are three independent searches that have run over the data. So two of them, PiCBC and GST-LAL, are independent meshed filter searches. And then we also have a search called Coherent Wave Burst, which does not use templates. So it requires there to be coherent power across your network of detectors. And even this search detects many of these events with fairly high significance, particularly those of high mass systems that are very well localized in time that will show up well on this wavelet projection. And then here you can also see the relative signal to noise ratios for each one of these searches.
Does this include events that haven't been disclosed yet?
It does not. It does not include events that haven't been well, I will start talking about the rate of candidates that we have been seeing from this current observing run, but they're not included here. So I would also be remiss to not mention that other teams do look at advanced LIGO data. So this is a release of significant candidate events from the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton. So here are six black hole candidates, and here is the chirp mass in units of solar masses, and then also the false alarm rate in units of the length of the second observing run. So these are six candidates in addition to the 11 events that I just showed you on the last slide, and with the false alarm rates that they've measured to be on the order of years. So they have a different target in the search. So we tend to take a more eyes wide open approach where we want to get every significant event, and they tend to restrict to looking at data that exactly matches essentially the templates that they're looking for. They assume that GR is true and completely true, and this allows them to reject a lot more data, but at the risk of missing some of the other signals that might be out there. So different, highly complementary approaches.
Sorry to keep asking questions.
No, please go ahead.
The Chi effectors are almost all around, clustered around zero.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is consistent with what we see as well for the 11 candidates. So I didn't show a map of the different measured spin values for our candidates, but it's consistent with what we've been seeing.
So there are two possibilities, because it's chi effective, it's weighted with mass.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So it could be that the black holes have tiny spins.
Yes. Yep, that very much could be true. Other questions? Yes, please go ahead.
You mentioned one difference is that they assume GR is completely right. So you mean for LIGO searches, you don't assume GR is right? You use non-GR waveforms to search?
We do not use non-GR waveforms. Allow me to construct that phrase a little bit more carefully. So if you remember back to our template bank, where there was some space between some of those dots, that's the allowed mismatch that we have. and I haven't checked the value of their allowed mismatch here, but essentially the data quality cut that they're doing is if there is non-stationarity present in the data that doesn't match the form of the signal that's included in their template bank, they throw it out. And that allows them to dig way deeper into the noise than a more eyes wide open approach would. Yeah, great questions. All right, so what have we learned astrophysically up to this point? So here's a schematic where this is the mass of the object in units of total mass, and the x-axis has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. But what you can see is in blue here, each one of these triple systems is a mass measured with gravitational waves, and each one of these purple dots is a black hole mass that was measured electromagnetically with an X-ray binary pair. So what we've seen from gravitational waves is that we are now probing a new regime of stellar mass black holes that are much heavier. So this is a bit biased, because what you can't also see from this image is that we're also probing much further out into space. Again, the strength of our signal going is 1 over r. So similarly down here, each one of these yellow dots is a neutron star mass that's measured electromagnetically, and then two orange dots for the LIGO-Virgo binary neutron star pair, which merge to form something that, as Cole very rightly pointed out, with gravitational wave information alone, we can't determine what that is, so it gets a question mark on the schematic.
What is the explanation for these big black hole masses compared to X-ray binary? X-ray binaries, we actually see a corpse black hole, whereas these other black holes are naked.
So the question is, what's the explanation for these heavier black hole masses? And then that's one question that we hope that gravitational waves will provide the answer to. So what is the formation mechanism of black holes that could form and also merge within a Hubble time with these kinds of masses? So once we get to a higher signal-to-noise ratio and we're better able to measure spin, as you mentioned, we should be able to start distinguishing between some of these potential formation mechanisms. Are they very heavy stars that are already in a binary orbit that become black holes? Do they form in this common envelope scenario? Are they dynamically captured in globular clusters? So spin should be a very interesting clue to answer exactly that.
Because the chance of stars to produce such a large black hole mass.
Sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
No metallicity.
That's right.
Things are working against those for collapse.
For some formation scenarios, that's very true. That's right.
Something hard going on.
Yes. Well, I think this is an exciting case of the experiment driving the theory. All right, other questions? Okay, so it might have occurred to you to wonder, how is it that we do all of this exciting astrophysical science with such a very simple measurement scheme? So the answer, of course, is that we don't. So this is the axis of reality, which takes us from this very simple schematic all the way to our fully realized 2.5 mile long, or 4 kilometers, I should say, here in Canada. 4 kilometer long interferometers. So they have hundreds of thousands of interconnected moving parts in very complicated relationships with their environments. So we're gonna take a tour to get a sense of what's involved in one of these advanced LIGO detectors. So this is LIGO Hanford, and this is actually the mid station. This isn't even the full length of the arm. That's only 2 kilometers away. So we're gonna zoom into what we call the large vacuum enclosure area, just for a really nice and hard to say acronym. So these vacuum chambers are about, let's say, 15 meters tall. And it's fully enclosed in this high performance vacuum. So we're gonna trace the path of the laser. So it comes into the interferometer here. It's steered into this 3 optic cavity in pink here. This is the input mode cleaner, which selects for this fundamental spatial Gaussian mode. And then it's steered into this 3 optic cavity in yellow. This is the power recycling cavity, and its job is to recycle the power that comes out of the beam splitter this way, but for now, our light will go to the beam splitter and then split 50% in each direction, exactly as we saw before in our more basic schematic. So now we're going to zoom out and see what the effect is of this Fabry-Perot cavity, where you have these two parallel optics that are recycling the light. So we actually get the light cycled up by a factor of about 300 from these Fabry-Perot cavities that are in the arms. And now we're going to zoom all the way out to the end station to get a look at what one of these optics looks like. So we call them test masses, similar to the ring of test masses that we first looked at, thinking about the properties of gravitational waves. So they weigh probably about 40 kilograms. So this beam size is about 6 centimeters. So they're really quite big. This helps with radiation pressure. So the light completes its journey in the arms. It comes back to the beam splitter. 50% goes to the power recycling cavity to get cycled back in, and 50% to this signal recycling cavity, which serves a similar purpose. And then finally, you see it steered to this four-optic output mode planar, which also selects for this fundamental Gaussian shape. And then finally to our output port. So to give you a rough sense of all of the different interrelated optical cavities that are involved in making this measurement. So here is the stretching and squeezing of the interferometer, all 4 kilometers of it. And this is the effect that we'd see at our output port. This change in the amplitude of the light at our photodiode corresponds to the gravitational wave strain that's passing through the detector. So what does our noise look like? So here is LIGO Livingston, and then we have O1 in green, the second observing run in orange, and the third observing run here in blue. So there are 3 different frequency regimes that tend to dominate our noise. So this is the stray noise amplitude versus frequency, just a simple Fourier transform. So at lower frequencies, we tend to be dominated by seismic motion and mechanical couplings to this low frequency motion of one optic relative to the other in each one of our arms. So at higher frequencies, we are fully quantum limited right now. So this is a shot noise curve. So when we're counting the amplitude of the light at our photodiode, this is essentially a photon counting experiment. And like any counting experiment, our noise is going to go as 1 over the square root of n. But for us, we get 1 over the square root of the power that's cycling in the arms. And there are different technologies we can employ to increase that value. And then in the middle here, so this is where we will be dominated by thermal noise once we come to rest on the Brownian motion of the optical coatings. So again, just to give you a sense of scale of the displacement measurement that we're making, it's the motion of the molecules in the coating relative to the other optic 4 kilometers away that will be introducing that source of noise. So I wanted to walk through.
Sorry. Dustin had a question first.
Oh, wait, just this is like way down in the weeds, but would you be willing to talk about some of the spikes? Like,
oh, sure.
60 hertz.
It is. 60 hertz in harmonics, you'll probably notice.
Yes.
There are many fun lines.
Amusing.
I don't know that we have any. I don't know that meets my definition of amusing. We certainly have some annoying lines. So you'll notice a lot of these lines that are constant between the different observing runs are things we can't change. So power lines, you pointed it out, 60 hertz in the U.S. and Canada. It's a little bit annoying that in Virgo this is 50 hertz. Yes, it's not the same, frequency. These are really, really massive lines that you see here starting at about 500 hertz. These are the violin modes, the mechanical modes of the suspensions themselves. So I'll be pointing this out in a couple slides, but each one of these test mass optics is hung from a very, very thin fiber suspension that's made of the same silica material, which really helps to reduce the thermal noise. But being very high Q, they have very high resonances at so the fundamental mode and then the harmonics. So those will be static. Those won't change. So the lines that you do see changing, so particularly these really strong lines down at lower frequencies, so those are injected lines. So those are either some hardware injection that's testing how well we can resolve a continuous wave signal from a spinning pulsar, or they're a calibration line that we use to convert this differential arm signal into space-time strain.
Thank you. So what happened from green, from O1 to O2 energy? It's a bit weird because it seems that in high frequency, O3 is much lower than O1 and O2, but low frequency, O2 and O3 are much lower than O1. So why is there? So I'm guessing one has to do with the power of the laser, and the other, I'm not sure, but it's the other.
Yes, this is also an excellent transition, which I will take advantage of presently. But if we get to the end of the next four slides and your question isn't answered, then please ask it again. All right, so let's start with lower frequencies. So here we are dominated by ground motion. So the technology that you see here, so particularly this blue pier structure, so this is outside of the vacuum chamber. So this is a hydraulically isolated active isolation system. And the way that it works is that you are essentially floating this big giant vacuum chamber on top of this blue pier here, which is isolated mechanically by fluid. And you're measuring what the ground motion is doing and then modeling your structure. You predict what the motion will be in response to that ground motion, and then you actively push on it to cancel it out. So we have one stage of this active isolation external to the vacuum, and two stages that are internal to the vacuum. And this technology is the primary reason why Advanced LIGO is sensitive to binary black hole systems now and wasn't in initial LIGO. So this gives us an enormous increase in sensitivity at about 50 hertz and below. So your question also relates to complicated interactions between angular and length control that we have much better models for between runs.
Is there
a
mystery noise?
Aha, I will address mystery noise a little bit. The answer to that, in summary, is yes, but it's understood much better now. And we expect that as our models improve, then we'll bridge that gap between the noise we understand and the noise we don't. All right, so right in the most sensitive frequency range, where we expect we will be dominated by the thermal noise of the optics, so again, this is governed by the mechanical properties of the optical coatings. So we have multiple layers of coatings and two different optical resonances that we're targeting. So one for our carrier frequency of light, which is near infrared, and the other two times that value, which is green light that we use to align the interferometer arms. And here, might actually be a little bit hard to see. They're very, very thin, but you can see these two few silica fibers that are actually holding up this test mass mirror to the stage above it. And then finally, we get to shot noise. So this is essentially what's going to be governing the differences between observing runs at higher frequencies, as you pointed out. So there are a few knobs we can turn here in order to get more power resonant in the arms. So one of them is to input more power. So this is an image of the Advanced LIGO pre-stabilized laser. So it's stabilized in amplitude and frequency. But otherwise, it's a ND-YAG 1064 nanometer laser. The other knob we can turn is to recycle more of this power, which we do in the two recycling cavities that you saw on our tour of Hanford. And there's one more knob that we can turn that's not related to the power in the arms, which is squeezing. So this is the first observing run that's employed light squeezing in both LIGO detectors. So the premise is that you have this light circulating in your detector, and then on the photodiode output side of the beam splitter, you're superimposing this coherent monochromatic light with this resonator, where you're selecting for the squeezed vacuum states. So, classically, if I don't have coherent states of light, so I don't have any correlations between photons, so I expect to see these equal phase and amplitude fluctuations. So here's an image of the scatter that you would see due to that type of effect that's superimposed on a sinusoidal signal. However, if I introduce these squeeze states, then I do correlate my photons, and I can either choose to reduce fluctuations in phase, which is important at higher frequencies for us, or fluctuations in amplitude, which are important at lower frequencies, which will motivate us in the future to do this frequency, a broadband multi-frequency range squeezing approach. So at higher frequencies right now, we're choosing to target phase fluctuations, and here's the effect that you can see again with the same sinusoidal signal buried in that noise. And here's the impact that it has on our sensitivity. So you can see this is a noise curve in orange for LIGO Hanford, and then one in LIGO for LIGO Livingston. So Hanford is currently squeezing at just over 2 decibels, which gives us about 15 extra megaparsecs. And for Livingston, it's just over 3, which gives us an extra 17 megaparsecs. And this is binary neutron star range.
But you've improved everywhere, not just high frequency or just low frequency, it's everywhere.
So right, so a shot noise is extremely broadband. So when we were looking at our full noise spectrum, so we're fully quantum limited, shot noise limited, all the way down to about 50, 60 hertz. So yes, that's exactly right. It's a very broad band.
Is there more plans to increase this?
Yes, there are. So we will be shutting down after the end of this current observing run for about a year and building about a 300 meter long optical cavity that's going to do squeezing and amplitude. This will reduce radiation pressure and get us a similar boost at lower frequencies. All right, so this is one of my favorite animations to show, so apologies if you've seen it before. But this is to scale how sensitive the measurement that we're able to make with all of these technologies and advances in engineering together. So zooming out from the hydrogen atom and the electron spinning around the proton, this is actually now, in 2019, about a factor of 2 less sensitive than we're currently able to measure. But to give you a sense of the scale of the relative displacement measurement that we do. So I also wanted to walk you through our noise budget. So this will address questions about mystery noise. There are a lot of curves on this plot that you shouldn't necessarily worry about. So this is, again, this isn't space-time strain amplitude. This is the differential arm measurement that's directly related to space-time strain. And then this is versus frequency. So these two fainter lines that you see here, so this is O1 and O2. And then I want to draw your attention to this black line here. So this is the sum of all known noise sources. And then just above that in blue is measured noise. So to your question about mystery noise, we have reduced the frequency range where we don't quite understand all of our noise sources together to below 100 hertz and above 30 or so. And we've also really pushed down on the amplitude difference between them. So as our noise models improve, particularly angle and length sensing and control, we're coming to understand our total noise budget a lot better. So similar for...
Is it possible to... Sorry, can I show the next slide?
Next slide? Okay.
Yeah, next slide. Is that might be more interesting.
It's a very similar plot. Okay. It's for the other detector.
I just can this be downloaded somewhere?
So that's a good question. So this is a plot made by one of the commissioners, Georgia Mansell, who was based at Hanford, I think, at the time that she made these. I would expect to find them in an A-log, an electronic log. I don't know if you, I'm happy to point you to the website for that. All right, so this is a very similar plot for what we just saw for Hanford. So we have two curves from the first two observing runs and this black line showing the sum of our known noise sources. And then just above it in places, we have our measured noise for O3, where we have a similar frequency range and amplitude range. It's not quite understood. That's likely related to these angle and length sensing noise sources.
So what's the difference between this and the previous one? They're both
the detector. So this is Livingston. Yep. Very sophisticated questions. You clearly heard about advanced LIGO before. So our detector noise is quite non-stationary, as you might expect for such a sensitive measurement. So here are two spectrograms broken out in frequency versus time, where the color indicates the excess power that's in that time series. So here is space-time strain data for LIGO Hanford, and here is data for a microphone near one of the input optics, so close to the input mode cleaner. Does anyone want to take a guess at what this is? This is a new noise feature to the third observing run.
Is
Any guesses? That's a pretty good guess. I'll give you a hint. This is a Doppler shift effect that you can see here.
Airplanes.
Very close. It's a helicopter. So this is a Chinook helicopter that flew right overhead the control room, and you can actually pinpoint the time that it passed overhead from the Doppler shift effect. So I had wanted to show a quick case study for anyone who might be interested in our open public alerts about the kind of impacts that terrestrial noise can have on our ability to communicate astrophysical results quickly. So this was a notable event from May 18th. So what was notable about it is that the probability that it had a remnant or had matter and therefore was likely to generate a kilonova was very high. And the sky map was extremely well localized, and the distance was about 30 megaparsecs, so about 10 megaparsecs closer than the binary neutron star detection from O2. So this quickly got a lot of follow-up efforts very excited, and then within the hour, we retracted it. So this was, whoever said earthquake before, this was an earthquake, so you were right in advance. So this is the space-time strain data for LIGO Hanford, and just a simple time frequency spectrogram. And just to give you a sense of what the template would have looked like if you projected it onto the data, it would have been sweeping up just about like this, catching this excess power here from this earthquake that very, very slowly rang down for tens of minutes. So something that I'm working on within the collaboration is what is the impact of different sources of noise on our ability to resolve parameters like sky location? So the premise is that you take some simulated signal, some injection, and then you inject this into some known noise source. So this is light scattering, which is really very common in both detectors. And then you compare these different quiet manifestations of Gaussian noise to what you get if you start to overlap some of this excess power from noise and your signal. So as we get more and more frequent detections, the scenario is occurring more and more often. So coming all the way back to your question about what exactly those two curves are. So this is the curve that you get if you treat all data as equal, and this is the curve that you get if you're careful about what background time or what time in your analysis you include as representative time. So what we do, the group that I lead, one of the primary things that we produce are these essentially scalpel cuts of data that we know is impacted by some source of environment or detector noise. And for this particular analysis, we got the significance of the event to improve by a factor of about 500. All right, so for my remaining negative minute or so, I just want to give an overview of the rest of the observing run, and then if you have any questions about the future of gravitational wave astronomy, I encourage you to come and find me. I'm here the whole rest of the day. So this is what we've seen so far in binary neutron star range. So this is the range at which we would detect a binary neutron star merger with a signal-to-noise ratio of 8. That's averaged over all of the sky positions, so it incorporates the sort of broadband frequency content from the detectors. So light blue is LIGO Livingston. You can see a gap here from a Hurricane Barry. Red is LIGO Hanford, and purple is Virgo. And each one of these points that is below the sort of median range average is due to transient noise, some glitch in the data. So we have had quite an exciting rate of events for anyone who's been paying attention to our open public alerts. So this is cumulative number of events or candidates that have not been retracted. And I got this plot from Frederic and Janine. So here in pink is the first observing run. In green is the second, where we do see this uptick here that is consistent with a Poissonian rate to about 2 sigma or so. And then here in blue is the third observing run so far. This plot is, I think, a few weeks old now, so we're already up to 40 total gold-plated events from O1 and O2 and non-retracted candidates from O3. So I have pretty much given up on upkeeping the schematic now. So this is each one of those unretracted candidates that, again, I took from Frederick and Janine, that's classified into likely binary black hole mergers, binary neutron stars, neutron star black hole, and this what we call a mass gap. And for candidates that are less than a week old, I just gave a plus one. This is, I'm going to have to think of another scheme for keeping track of these. It's a very labor-intensive way to show it. But what you're seeing here, each one of these bar graphs is showing the frequentest probability that the template has some, the two component masses fall within some value. So for binary black holes, this is above 5 solar masses. Both of the component masses are above 5. BNS, they're both below 3. NSBH, one is below 3, one is above 5. And mass gap, at least one of them is between 3 and 5 solar masses. And then here are the likely terrestrial unretracted events. So that's about 30 so far, if you're counting.
So those probabilities don't really have anything to do with signal to noise or how certain you are that it is, in fact, an actual gravitational wave event. It's just the area within the posterior in mass.
This is actually not a Bayesian treatment. So this is the output of the match filter searches.
Okay.
So you do incorporate some information from the false alarm rate, but I will put an asterisk next to that and say that this works better for some noise models and some pipelines than others. This was written for the GST-Lowell pipeline. But yes, it's essentially taking the most likely fit from your matched filter search, and then we'll do a much more nuanced job offline with parameter estimation.
So what about neutron star black hole? Do we think we have some?
We do. So there are 4 now. I was a little bit lazy when I was writing this talk this week, and I just gave one a plus one. And I also need to increase this number to 3. Well, a 4. Yes. Okay. But yes, so there are 4 of them in total that are more likely by this frequentist metric to be a neutron star black hole than anything else. But again, this could change for the catalog. We don't, I think, expect all of these events to be represented as gold-plated significant detections.
Was there any electromagnetical counterpart like measured from the binary neutron stars?
Nothing? Not that I know of, no. Not yet. They're much more distant than the first one was, so it's not unexpected.
What's the total mass of the new binary neutron stars?
That is something that I may not tell you. The question was what the masses are.
Okay.
You had a question?
I was just wondering, you didn't really like as we were increasing all the sensitivities, we're seeing further and further out. But then for things like binary neutron star particle, are we also getting less likely to see counterparts because of this whole, yes, we'll see more gravitationally, but it's more difficult?
That's exactly right. That's the selection effect that we're encountering.
Any high spins on the black holes? Or
sorry, any
high spin?
That's something else that I can't tell you about these. We could talk about the candidates from the first two observing runs, though there are some candidates for non-zero spin. I don't know if I would say high, but the data is consistent with a significant non-zero spin for at least 15, 12, 26, I think. All right, other questions? I won't dip too much further into my negative time, but I do want to give you a roadmap for the rest of the observing run. So we're currently in the middle of a one-month commissioning break where we're going to be venting. So venting means that we're filling the vacuum chamber up with air and making some small instrumental improvements. And then we will be running until the end of April 2020. That will be the end of the third observing run. And we do expect Kagra to join us in probably January or so, or 2020. And their expected range will probably be about 10 megaparsecs or so. Okay, and I think since I'm over time, I will end it here. But if you would like to talk about the future of gravitational wave astronomy, I am in office 359.
Yes, I've got a lot of questions, but any other quick questions?
Has the source of lip glitches been identified?
That's a wonderful question, and very near and dear to my heart. So No, the source of bloat glitches has not been identified. So Miriam Cabero-Mueller, who's currently a postdoc at Princeton, showed that some significant fraction of them, to the order of 10% or so, were associated with computer timing errors. But that's only one subpopulation. So this is a glitch that's particularly insidious because it takes up the same time, frequency, space, and morphology as a high mass system with anti-aligned spin. So they really contribute in not quite blind, but really interfere with our ability to resolve those types of signals. So unfortunately, no, not yet. We have worse ones in this realm, though.
About the noise. The noise can also come from the real gravitational wave signal from binary orbiting. So whole fraction of the noise is from this kind of objects.
So this is something that we haven't quite encountered yet, this either a stochastic gravitational wave background or a background of popcorn-like sources from distant mergers that we can't resolve individually, but interfere with our ability to resolve single sources. And it's debatable whether or not Advanced LIGO will reach that limit, but this is definitely a thought for LISA, which absolutely will. So
LISA can distinguish each orbiting system. But here, if we know how much of the orbiting system in our universe, we can predict what's the amplitude of the noise can be contributed by these objects. If the noise right now observed is too big, and we cannot constrain the population of the binaries, but if the noise we observe is very, very small, we can constrain.
That's true. The frequency distribution of our unexplained mystery noise is inconsistent with that model right now, because we only see it below, I think it's 100 hertz for Hanford, and then 50 hertz for Livingston. I might have them backwards. But that's not quite consistent with what you'd expect to see from an astrophysical distribution of binary black hole signals. But we are also steadily chipping away at the uncertainty in the rates in the universe at which we'd expect to see these types of mergers. So we will we'll come at it from both angles.
Okay. Well, Jess will be around all day if you want to ask her more questions or talk with her. But thank her again.